From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This is it, OTM's last hour of campaign coverage. Our long national nightmare is nearly at an end. Reporters will disembark the campaign buses and planes. Talking heads will cease blathering about the horse race and start blathering about exit polls. TV stations will be without the campaign ads that have kept the troubled industry briefly in clover. And cable news will soon be without dueling sound bites to parse. Which means, watch out, we're about to hear a lot more about missing blondes and the war on Christmas.
Yep, after two solid years of posturing and pandering, smearing and smiling, punditry and palaver, we get to choose a president. Luckily, the news media have been with us every step of the way, so there isn't a single thing, not one single detail about these candidates that we as an electorate haven't had a chance to sort out. Journalism has done itself proud, except
for a couple of things it wasn't quite able to nail down. Oh, William Ayers and the Bridge to Nowhere and the Reverend Wright and Totally Cute Lobbyists, that's all been nailed left, right, and center. But there are a few items that have slipped between the cracks, which has something to do with journalistic failure and something to do with what they call politics as usual. After 8 years of maybe the most opaque presidency ever, the two supposed candidates of change haven't been so utterly forthcoming. According to Kenneth Vogel, who rounded up some unanswered questions this week for Politico.com, when it comes to transparency, the times aren't necessarily a-changin'.
That's right, and there is an increased expectation because there's so much interest in this race, and it's gone on for so long. And they've tried to one-up one another on the transparency front by releasing documents that they aren't required to release and demanding that their opponent does the same.
Well, give me some examples of the kind of material that the press is trying to get that the campaigns have not been forthcoming in releasing.
Well, Barack Obama talks about his time as a civil rights lawyer before he was elected to the Illinois State Senate. And he worked for a firm that, in fact, did do a lot of civil rights cases, but it also did kind of a lot of transactional law, just normal stuff, estates, contracts, stuff like that. And Obama has not released the list of clients that he represented, though he did, when he was in the state Senate, release a list of all the clients that the firm represented, which leaves us with literally hundreds of clients on these long lists, but really not much in the way of information as to which of these cases that he worked on.
And now the reason that's significant is, well, it's a perfunctory enough exercise just to release a list of your clientele. If someone's name on there has some sort of unsavory past or associations, like Tony Rezko, then Obama has still more explaining to do.
That's right. And in fact, on the list of clients that the firm represented, there are some names that I think would raise eyebrows, including William Moorhead. This is a developer who was convicted of stealing more than $1 million from public housing projects he managed and developments he co-owned with the partner in Obama's firm, a former partner, Allison Davis. And some of these thefts occurred while Moorhead was a client of the firm.
All right. What else can we get our hands on?
McCain's financial disclosure of tax information has not satisfied certainly Democrats, as well as some reporters who pointed out that most presidential candidates in the modern era have released substantially more information on their taxes. And of course, this is something that has been of interest, particularly because Cindy McCain is the heiress to a beer distributorship fortune worth as much as some estimates say $100 million. And it kind of harkens back, Democrats say, to Republicans' demands in 2004 for Theresa Heinz Kerry, the wife of the Democratic nominee John Kerry, to release more information on her finances.
McCain did permit reporters to pore over his 3,000-some pages of medical records, but wouldn't permit them to make any photocopies or even to make phone calls to medical experts. Did the nominal release of the information do any reporters any good?
Well, it certainly didn't satisfy a number of medical experts and a number of medical journalists. It should be pointed out that Joe Biden has had some health problems. In 1988, he says he nearly died from a brain aneurysm, and he also did not actually release his medical records, but rather allowed reporters to come in and take a look at them without the advantage that perhaps more time and more expertise could afford to them in doing an analysis as to whether, in fact, he is healthy.
Now, in your story in Politico, you refer to a mess of other documents that have been unavailable, including Barack Obama's Columbia thesis and Sarah Palin's college transcripts. But maybe the most pertinent missing records are those of Governor Palin's emails. Can you describe that situation?
That's right. Sarah Palin conducted state business on a Yahoo account. And that has kind of provoked interest in what she was emailing. So many media outlets, including the Associated Press, requested that the Alaska state government, under Alaska's public records law, produce all the emails that Sarah Palin sent and received during her nearly 2 years as governor. The Alaska state government came back to the AP and said that they would charge AP 10 cents per printed page of emails plus $960 for each state employee's account. These are folks who may have sent emails to or received emails from Sarah Palin. Some folks have done the math, and it would come to $15 million to produce these emails. It's unclear whether any media outlets have, in fact, taken them up on that offer. So it's kind of an open question that, headed into Election Day, probably unlikely to get an answer to.
Well, Ken, thank you.
Thank you very much. Love the show.
Thanks. Kenneth Vogel is a reporter for Politico.com.
Whether you pull a lever or punch a card or put your finger on a screen, you always pull the curtain. Because voting is private, right? David Ardia, the director of the Citizen Media Law Project at Harvard University, says it doesn't have to be. He wants people to take cameras into the polling place and document their votes. He believes that with a few million cell phone cameras and a handful of newly launched Election Watch websites, voters can begin to repair our glitch-laden election system ourselves. The data can be posted and assessed, and maybe, just maybe, some voting irregularities can be fixed before the polls close. The only problem is that in at least six states, it's illegal to snap a pic of your completed ballot, because if people could prove their votes, they could sell them, or worse, be coerced to vote a certain way. As for the other 44 states, Ardia says that even if you wanted to abide by the voting laws, good luck figuring out what they are.
They're not easy to find. They're full of legal jargon that is ambiguous, especially when applied to modern technologies. You then have to deal with how your own polling place workers have interpreted the law through their training, if they've even had training on this issue.
But I'm not sure how photographing the ballot can actually help iron out these irregularities. I mean, you're mainly interested in addressing irregularities in nearly real time, right? And I don't see how a picture of your ballot can do that.
First, the thing to remember is that it isn't just someone taking an image of their actual ballot. It's their entire experience in voting, from arriving at the polling place, waiting in line. It isn't simply a focus on having someone take a video image of their marked ballot. But even in that narrow piece of information, let's say, for example, that someone who voted in Florida in 2000 and was faced with the butterfly ballot, couldn't figure out who they were voting for. The ability to take a picture of it and to share it with others to say, does anyone else find this confusing? If they're leaving the polling place and they're uploading it and a few minutes later it pops up on a voter suppression wiki or it pops up on YouTube or one of these other services, all of a sudden now there's an opportunity to actually get corrective ballots out to a polling place in enough time to actually impact the current election.
But this information, you know, goes up into the ether. Maybe it'll pop up on a wiki or on a voter suppression site. If there is no one central area gathering this data, how can it be assessed? Is there a meta site?
I'm not aware of a site right now that is aiming to be that meta site. These are experiments, and so some of these sites are going to do it better than others. As time goes on, we will end up with perhaps one place or a series of places where our voters can go and get a real-time picture of what's going on in the election that aggregates information from all of these different sources.
I don't have to tell you how partisan this whole argument over voter fraud and voter suppression is, has always been, and especially since Florida in 2000. How do you know that the information you're getting hasn't been fixed?
First, we look for enough information to start to outweigh the few individuals who are looking to game the system. And so through what's sort of crowdsourcing type effect, the truth of what's going on will begin to become clear. The other way that this can be addressed is this is an opportunity for traditional media organizations to use this information. You see something coming up in a polling place outside a major city, for example, in Ohio. It's an opportunity to go to that location, start to interview voters, start to find out what it is that's perhaps causing these reports to come in. And through that process, we begin to become more certain that the information is reliable.
So, David, to what extent is your goal to highlight the unbelievably disorganized voting process in America? Are you hoping that this photography will be a force that pushes real reform?
I absolutely hope so. You know, one of the problems with election reform has been the dispersed nature of the problems. Problems with voting machines, long lines, registration problems. Those are affecting a lot of voters. But because they're happening largely to individuals and because there hasn't in the past been a way of really assessing the wide extent, they haven't formed an impetus for voting reform. This is an opportunity to collect this information certainly on a more comprehensive way and to do so in a relatively real time so that we can start to see what's really going on election day.
I just want to thank you so much for doing this. I know some people have nightmares about, you know, the credit crunch, and some people have nightmares about loose nukes, but I actually have had nightmares about stolen elections.
I hope that the video, Your Vote, that this is an opportunity to shine sunlight as the best disinfectant on preventing those things from happening.
David Ardia is director of the Citizen Media Law Project and a fellow at the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can link to his site for a list of places to post your information at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, when it comes to getting out the vote, nothing works better than the personal touch.
And how Anna Marie Cox got her ticket to ride. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Since the first of the year, more than $1 billion has been spent on political and issue ads. According to a recent study, the Obama campaign was on track to spend more than $100 million on TV ads in October alone. Then, of course, there are the direct mail campaigns, the email blasts, the door-to-door efforts, and the robocalls like this one.
Hello. I'm calling for John McCain and the RNC because you need to know that Barack Obama has worked closely with domestic terrorist Bill Ayers, whose organization bombed the U.S. Capitol, the Pentagon, a judge's home, and killed Americans. And Democrats will enact an extreme leftist agenda if they take control of Washington.
No matter the method, the point is first to lure people to vote and then to affect how they vote. But are these pricey appeals really doing the trick? Donald Green, director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale, has spent years assessing the power of all these methods to both mobilize and persuade voters. Green found that campaigns generally aren't getting much bang from their bucks.
We've conducted many, many studies, more than 100 in all, and the basic message of the studies that we've done is fairly clear, and that is that by and large, the more personal, the more authentic, the more effective things are. When things are impersonal and mass-produced, as in the case of direct mail or robotic phone calls, they tend to be relatively ineffective.
But exactly how ineffective are they, TV ads and robocalls? Do they have no effect at all on the outcome?
Well, we've studied robocalls by celebrities, by governors, by local officials, by local clergy, partisan, nonpartisan. We just don't find any effect on whether people vote. That we're pretty sure about, that their effects on mobilization are very meager.
What about TV advertising? I mean, that's where the lion's share of money is spent.
Only one randomized study of which I know has looked at the effects of TV advertising on vote choice. We did find a momentary effect. The effect lasted a few days, but a week later it was all gone.
And you found that person-to-person pitches, even door-to-door appeals, are really the effective way to go, but it takes a lot more time and money. Can you break down the different methods into a dollar per vote figure?
We do try. So the most personal might be a door-to-door visit, conversation at one's doorstep. Yeah, that produces votes that could be quite costly if you're paying well-paid, well-trained volunteers. But if you've got a truly volunteer effort, it can be quite inexpensive. So the typical figure is something in the order of, you know, $20 to $30 per vote, which sounds like a lot. But you have to remember that a direct mail campaign might cost maybe three times that, five times that. Phone calls. Volunteer phone calls are quite cost effective, particularly volunteer phone calls where a caller will call you up and say, Brooke, can I count on you to vote? And if you say yes, maybe you get a return phone call the day before the election saying, you know, now, Brooke, can I count on you to make good on your promise tomorrow? That has a huge effect. Whereas a call from a telemarketing firm tends to have a fairly minimal effect, and a robocall seems to have no effect at all.
And yet, going against this trend is some new research that shows that text messages really are quite effective, especially when you take into account how cheap they are to send. I understand a text message costs about 6 cents per contact, and it comes to about $1.50 per vote. How come texts pack more punch than emails or robocalls?
Now, it might have to do with the nature of the lists. These are opt-in lists, and people have agreed to be reminded.
If it is an opt-in list, doesn't that kind of cast deep shadow over this research? Because if people are saying, go ahead, contact me, then they're already in the tank, so to speak.
Maybe so. Maybe there's a behavioral readiness on their part. And when they finally get the reminder, they're ready to run with it. And we'll see whether that works for a generic list of people. What's fascinating about it is maybe the way in which people relate to their cell phones. The cell phone commands and I must obey. And if it reminds me to vote, I go vote. But we really don't fully understand why it is that this impersonal tactic seems to work with the effectiveness of a personal tactic.
Now let's move to another study you did on less traditional ways to get out the vote.
Well, let me give you a little bit of background on these studies. They are inspired by our reading of 19th century American history. Americans turned out at, you know, 80%+ rates, sometimes 90%+ rates, despite the fact that it was a very poor period in American history. People were relatively uneducated, and it was very difficult to register to vote. Usually there was only one day when you could register to vote. Despite all those things, turnout was very high. And so a lot of this research is inspired by an effort to recreate some of the circumstances of 19th century voting. And one of those was the fact that one would vote in public, often hanging around the polling place for hours, imbibing a little whiskey, maybe arguing, maybe brawling. After all, a men-only affair, and people were there to see and be seen as voters. With the progressive reforms of 1889 and after, voting became a kind of solitary affair, something you did in relative anonymity. And so the experiments that you're referring to were an attempt to remind people that voting is a matter of public record and that they would be seen as to whether they voted or not.
Tell me how the study was structured.
The study was designed to measure the effects of increasing amounts of social surveillance, if you will. The first group got nothing. There was a control group. Another group was told, you know, voting is a matter of civic duty, so please go out and vote. Another group was told voting is a matter of civic duty, and researchers will be studying whether you vote or not, but they won't contact you in any way. The next treatment examined a mailing that said voting is a matter of civic duty, do your civic duty, it's a matter of public record, and showed people whether or not they and their housemates had voted in the last two elections. And finally, the strongest treatment was one that encouraged people to do their civic duty, reminded them that voting is a matter of public record, showed them whether they and their housemates had voted in the last two elections, and showed them whether 10 of their neighbors had voted in the last two elections, and presumably showed their neighbors whether they had voted. And the last two treatments, the ones that reveal whether people had voted in the last two elections, had enormously strong effects relative to direct mail, which almost never has an effect.
It boosted voting in these studies by what, 26%?
Yeah, 26%. And so the question is, you know, what's going on there in terms of a social psychological mechanism? And I think that part of it is people realize, oh, if it's a matter of public record, well, then I can't say I voted and not really vote. I actually have to go vote.
Donald Green is a director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale and author of the book, Get Out the Vote. Donald, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
A Opponents of Proposition 8 said gay marriage has nothing to do with schools. Then a public school took first graders to a lesbian wedding, calling it a teachable moment.
That's tape from a television ad funded by ProtectMarriage.com, part of its effort to get out the vote on a California ballot initiative known as Proposition 8. If passed, Prop 8 would, quote, change the California Constitution to eliminate the right of same-sex couples to marry. Prominently featured in the ad is video of school children attending the same-sex wedding of their teacher in mid-October, video originally published by the website of the San Francisco Chronicle. Whatever you think of Prop 8, is it fair use for news footage to be expropriated for political purposes? Lawrence Lessig is a professor at Stanford Law School and founder of the Center for Internet and Society. He joins me now. Lawrence, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
At least some object to the way these kids were used, mainly their parents who happened to be against Proposition 8. Four of them wrote a letter to the Yes on 8 campaign demanding that they stop running the ad. And they also sent a letter to the San Francisco Chronicle asking the publisher to intervene on their behalf. Do these parents have any legal claim concerning the video images of their children?
Well, I find myself in a really conflicted position because I strongly oppose Prop 8, but I also strongly oppose the law standing in the middle of these political campaigns and trying to adjudicate what speech can be used in a very hotly contested political context. So I don't think the law should stop the ability of people to use material that's been publicly distributed. Although the claims here are quite complicated. On the one hand, there's fair use, which is about the copyright issue, about using copyrighted work that was published by some news organizations, for example. But on the other hand, there's also potentially a right to privacy or publicity issue, where if you use somebody's image in an advertisement, then that raises legal questions as well. Now, typically that's for commercial purposes, but I know lawyers are quite eager to extend that as broadly as it can be extended.
What about the fact that the subjects in question here are children? Do the parents enjoy some special protection, either under fair use law or under privacy law?
They enjoy extraordinary protection under the law called decency. And so I fully understand and agree with them that they don't want their kids to be used in a political football match. The interests weighing in favor of privacy and control of rights of publicity are stronger for children than they are for adults, certainly. But again, I would hope the law could stay out because that's become such a nightmare, especially in the presidential campaign right now.
Now, apart from the question of whether it's right or wrong to use these kids to flog a political point of view, there's also the question of using copyright as a kind of bludgeon to stifle political speech. That's come up a lot in the campaign when stuff shows up on YouTube that has been plucked from, for example, cable news. Can you tell me about that issue?
What's basically happening is that very efficient systems that were created for copyright holders to enforce their rights are being deployed in a political way, really to silence speech. So this has happened with John McCain's campaign. In the primary, he used a clip from Fox News, which Fox News then threatened if he didn't take down. It's happened to him again in the general election. It's happened to Barack Obama's campaign in the presidential election. It's happened in local races, too, where these absurd claims of copyright have been raised, not so much because anybody actually believes the copyright claims would survive, but because they know that if YouTube, for example, takes down a video for 10 days before it's finally adjudicated whether it can go up or down, it can really interfere with the campaign on the other side. So it's become a political tool, a weapon, to fight the opponent by censoring their speech rather than just responding on the merits to what they've said.
Now, a lot of these issues were supposed to have been legislated in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998. But I gather you think that that law is flawed, to say the least.
Nobody was ever thinking about how important sites like YouTube would be to political speech when they passed the DMCA almost exactly 10 years ago this week. What they missed was that by giving copyright owners such a simple way to get speech taken down, they would create the incentive for this political gamesmanship.
So what's the fix here?
Well, I think one of the problems we have here is that copyright is trying to do too much. It's trying to regulate wildly more speech than it needs to. Its function is to create incentives for people to create great new works. So I think part of the solution here is just try to carve a copyright back to protect the work of Lyle Lovett or to protect the work of some great new singer and not worry so much about using it or allowing it to be used to regulate every time some speech gets uttered on the internet. That's too much for the law of copyright to bear.
Now, I have never asked this question of an interviewee in 8 years, but I'm going to ask it of you. Lyle Lovett? What the hell? Where did that come from?
Oh, come on. Lyle's great.
Lawrence, as always, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lawrence Lessig is a professor at Stanford Law School and author of Remix, published by Penguin.
The Christian Science Monitor announced that starting next April, the daily print edition will no longer be soiling your fingers. Instead, it'll arrive in subscribers' inboxes as a PDF file. There will still be a weekly print edition, but the Monitor soon will become the first national newspaper that will no longer be an actual daily paper.
These days, there's a constant stream of bad news about venerable print products. This week, the Gannett Company, publisher of 85 dailies and more than 800 local non-dailies, announced it would be cutting 10% of its workforce after a nearly 18% drop in ad revenue. The perpetually beleaguered LA Times recently announced another 10% reduction of its editorial staff, 200 layoffs this time. And last week at the Newark Star-Ledger, 151 people in a newsroom of about 330 took buyout deals. Some have already begun to flee the nation's 15th largest newspaper.
The good news for the Star-Ledger is that it still exists. Seriously, the paper almost went under this month. And of course, magazines are also going under the knife. This week, Time Inc. announced it's cutting 6% of its workforce, about 600 people. And the New York Observer reported Thursday that ritzy Condé Nast glossies like The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Wired, Glamour, Vogue, and GQ must cut 5% from both their editorial and their business sides.
And if you still do have a job at a media organization, the party's over. Literally. ABC News President David Weston told staff in a memo this week that in order to save money, holiday parties this year are canceled, along with magazine and newspaper subscriptions. Weston advised staffers to read those online, now the only place to find the Christian Science Monitor, but unfortunately for ABC, not for free.
One final media casualty, Radar Magazine, whose tagline is Pop Culture for Smart People, folded last week. Its website remains, but now the focus will be on celebrities with no place for political stories or political reporters. That's how Radar reporter Anna Marie Cox found herself with a press pass and a seat on the McCain plane, but no money to cover the cost of covering the candidate. Cox does blog for Time magazine, but it had its own reporters on the trail, and the Washington Independent chipped in only a small portion of her fare. So Cox took a route all too familiar to us and you. She launched a personal pledge drive on her blog. She asked readers to donate money to get her through the last week of the campaign, and she's even offering pledge premiums. We reached her Wednesday on a Palin press van en route to Kentucky. The VP candidate, Cox explained, was making a Halloween-y campaign stop.
Palin just is visiting a pumpkin patch right now. There are pumpkins that are apparently a dollar off today.
Explain now the pledge levels and the pledge prizes. This is a public radio audience, so you probably don't have to start from scratch.
they totally know what I'm talking about. Well, $10 would give you a thank you email. $250 would offer the opportunity for someone to provide a question for me to ask of a senior McCain advisor. And then I would record my asking the question and the answer to it and send it to them as an MP3 file. For $1,000, I would have a post-election dinner debriefing.
People have pledged over $8,000. Most of those are in small pledges?
That's true. It is still probably not quite enough to really cover the entire thing through election day, but I'm keeping track of my expenses on my blog as well and letting people know sort of where the money's going.
And how many dinners will you be having with donors, and who's going to pay for it?
So far, there are two dinners that I will be having. I was hoping maybe they would let my husband cook it.
Do you think you're feeling some pressure to do an even better job because you've been in touch with these people who are willing to shell out directly to keep you on that plane and on that van?
I am so grateful and amazed and humbled that people are helping me out at all. And so I feel much more pressure to provide good customer service than I have at any of the publications that I've worked for. And in some ways, it's an ideal situation for the typical antisocial blogger. There's no office politics. There's no resentments of any kind of anyone. But I have to also say that I could not do this, you know, full time, if only because I've written so many thank you notes. My fingers are getting a little tired.
I wonder if the McCain campaign is aware of your project and if they've had any reaction.
They are aware of my project because they are amused by it.
So far, no one has asked you to ask a question of any McCain or Palin campaign staffers. I guess that's good in a way, because what if they ask you to ask McCain if he wears briefs or boxers?
You know, people have asked McCain far stupider questions. I did an interview on network television today where someone asked me if Sarah Palin was still wearing her expensive clothes or she started wearing her regular clothes. And I had to answer that, you know, it's not the first question I would ask Sarah Palin these days. I mean, if that's the first question that occurs to a major media reporter to ask Sarah Palin, maybe a reader would come up with something better.
Anna Marie Cox is a Wonkette Emerita, a blogger for Time Magazine and a political reporter for her own blog, annamariecox.typepad.com, which we will link to from our site on themedia.org. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
Coming up, the confessions of a current campaign reporter.
And a look back at an old one, Hunter Thompson. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Like cowboys in winter, campaign reporters are bidding farewell to the dusty trail and reflecting on the times they shared. The New York Times' Matt Bai told The New Republic, with grave admiration, "There are guys who went out to the primaries in November and December, and they thought they'd be done in February or March, and they just never came home. They never came home." Michael Hastings wasn't one of those reporters. He recently wrote a tell-all in GQ where he described his unique assignment for Newsweek, which was to follow whoever he thought was the frontrunner and gather material for a piece that would run after the election. But he just couldn't make it to the end. Now he's reporting for GQ in Kabul, Afghanistan. He said covering the candidates was uncomfortably similar to another experience he had on the campaign trail at night in the hotel watching porn.
You see two people perform. You're kind of envious of them. You know, you sort of like it when one of them gets humiliated, and the best clips get sent around the internet.
I think you hit all the notes you hit in the article, except that you do it for too long and you just start feeling kind of bad.
Yeah, you do feel bad about yourself, and you're like, man, maybe I should get married, or maybe I should get a life or go exercise more.
Actually, that's where I want to go next, is to your experiences on the various campaigns. Initially, of course, Rudolph Giuliani was believed to be the Republican frontrunner, and starting right there, at the beginning of your long adventure, you explode the notion that reporters who are, after all, human, can avoid forming attachments or violent antipathies to certain candidates. You felt distinctly uncomfortable on the Giuliani bus.
I did. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things people have said about this piece is, oh, you know, you're exposing liberal bias or whatever. I think the bias argument is pretty, that's not something that really interests me. What interests me is sort of the human relationships that go on, whatever you're covering. And with Giuliani, you know, I'd spent 2 years off and on covering the war in Iraq and had a lot of people I know and loved affected by that war. And then to see a guy who was so casually flinging around violent threats and saying, oh, we need to have more torture, and, oh, yeah, we need to bomb Iran. And I don't think he really has a clue about what war is actually like. I mean, he had a number of deferments in Vietnam, and he's never been to Iraq or Afghanistan.
You thought he was a hypocrite.
Hypocrite, yeah. We love hypocrites in journalism. Once people start telling the truth, then you can't accuse them of being hypocrites. That's the problem.
After Giuliani's campaign went down in a whimper, you switched to Hillary Clinton's campaign when she was presumed to be the front runner, and the campaign staff had set you up during a Clinton town meeting in Austin, Texas, in a men's bathroom.
Right, yeah, they put us in the urinal, they put us in the bathroom, which is definitely the low point of the campaign experience. You know, I mean, the media has not necessarily been very kind to Senator Clinton. If I was in her shoes, I'd probably hate us too, but then it's a matter of, okay, you can hate us, but you still have to work with us in some way.
You said that traveling with the Hillary campaign was like being in a gulag on wheels.
Yeah. You know, it was this weird phenomenon where I found myself just eating myself to death. They feed you constantly on every plane ride, every event. And so you're going to 5-6 events a day. You're taking 3-5 plane rides a day. You find yourself constantly eating all this food. You're sort of trapped with them. They're showing you where you're supposed to sleep. They're telling you when to get off the bus, when you can take a picture, when you can talk to the candidate. And for me, the food, I was like, one day I had like 4 Butterfingers, and, you know, like before like 3 o'clock, you know, with like a croissant and an omelet.
That can't be good.
I think I had gained like 10 pounds.
But you say that this kind of dependent relationship creates a kind of reporting that is founded on a very dysfunctional relationship.
Here's the thing. In reporting, there's always these kind of relationships with sources that can be awkward at times and can put you in compromising positions. But with campaign reporting, you're sort of a cross between a celebrity gossip reporter and an ESPN football analyst. The difference, though, is that in football, if you're analyzing, you're not the referee. Well, the media actually plays the part of both the referee and the analyst in the game. Mm. So you're sort of setting up these narratives and seeing if the candidates will jump over these hurdles. So you're much more a part of the story than in any other kind of reporting that I'd ever experienced, which in turn makes the relationship even that much more complicated.
You had the opportunity to hop again onto another front runner, that was McCain's bus, and you decided not to. In fact, you essentially walked away from the assignment before it was over. How come?
I think if you really love reporting politics, then you will report on any politics. And if that's your passion, that's what you want to do, I say go for it. For me, I realized that to go through this process again of meeting McCain's aides and digging my way into the inner circle to get these exclusive tidbits of information and sort of tell the story of McCain in the hotel room with an empty Pepsi and pizza, and he's waiting on, you know, the returns to come in, and Cindy McCain says this and Meghan McCain says that. I just felt that I wanted to go off and try to tell other stories that I felt more passionately about. And, you know, and I thought McCain is totally nuts. And I would be doing a disservice.
And by the way.
Yeah, and by the way, yeah. But it was a personal decision. I mean, I just really felt that, to be honest with myself and to be honest with the people I would be working with and covering, it made more sense to just sort of step out of the race.
You ended your piece by quoting from Robert Novak's autobiography, The Prince of Darkness. He wrote, "I awaited my 30th birthday with the grim recognition that I was only a hack." Now, you were worried about ending up as a lifelong hack, and now we're talking to you from Afghanistan. Is there a connection?
Well, I think the connection is what Novak did was he wrote what he believed in the end. You know, you can say what you want about the guy, but he ended up writing what he believed in. And for me, I felt I need to do stories that I really believe in, and this last month I've had the opportunity to be in Afghanistan and to see what's happening here, and it's what I love to write about, not politics, not whether Sarah Palin is really lipstick on a pig or whatever the daily sort of news tidbit is. You know, this is probably egotistical, and people are going to say, oh, that Hastings, he's full of himself again. Or maybe they won't. They'll be like, who is that guy? But essentially, there's so many people, so many talking heads, so many guys trying to cover this election. And what's really anyone saying? Where in a story like Afghanistan or other stories that are sometimes undercovered, you really have a chance to say something original and something that, you know, maybe people aren't really paying attention to.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Michael Hastings covered the campaign for Newsweek and is the author of I Lost My Love in Baghdad. He is now in Kabul, Afghanistan, for GQ.
In addition addition to being a chronicler of the renegade biker gang, the Hell's Angels, a vocal proponent of drug use, and an autobiographical magician who turned his own fear and loathing into at least two American classics, Hunter S. Thompson was a campaign reporter. Of course, he treated politics like he did his other subjects, with foul language, bad behavior, and an intimacy that had nothing to do with objectivity. He was the anti-hero journalist who sloppily swallowed the 1972 presidential campaign and then regurgitated it in the pages of Rolling Stone. And so, as the current horse race comes to a finish, we thought we'd look back now at how Thompson covered the sport. William McKean is the chair of the Journalism Department at the University of Florida and author of Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Most people believe that Hunter Thompson's political writing started with the 1972 presidential campaign. But in fact, he wrote about Richard Nixon well before that, in 1968. Tell me about that piece.
Well, it was a piece he wrote for Paget magazine, which I recall being something kind of like the Reader's Digest, sort of a bland coffee table magazine you'd find in your folks' house or your grandparents' house. And so when I look back and started reading Hunter's writing for Paget, and he wrote four pieces, I was kind of surprised at the bile he had for Nixon that made it into print, because he says here, Richard Nixon has never been one of my favorite people anyway. For years, I've regarded his very existence as a monument to all the rancid genes and broken chromosomes that corrupt the possibilities of the American dream.
Seeing that in Paget magazine would be the equivalent of maybe seeing someone described as a scum-sucking pig on the cover of Parade magazine today.
Right. But he did have his famous interview with Richard Nixon then. It's just that the subject was limited to pro football.
What was famous about the interview?
Well, not many people got a private audience with Nixon then. Nixon was the master of creating that control-your-environment approach to the campaign, where he'd have these staged, televised town hall meetings, and everyone in the audience was handpicked. So the press was really frustrated that it couldn't get close to him. And Hunter was one of those reporters following Nixon around in the early days of the primary. And after an event one night in New Hampshire, he was getting juiced at the bar with some of his other reporters when one of the Nixon aides came in and said, "Listen, the old man has a 75-minute drive to the airport to catch his private Learjet. He wants to talk football. None of us know football. Thompson, you know football. Will you sit with the president and talk to him? And the minute you bring up any other subject but football, we're dumping you out of the car by the side of the road in the frozen tundra of New Hampshire." So he said, okay.
Thompson had begun his journalism career as a sports writer for the Air Force Base newspaper in Florida.
Right. And he'd always been interested in sports, saw himself as an athlete until he sort of fell under the spell of booze and tobacco. But afterward, he said, "I went to New Hampshire with the idea that Richard Nixon was a monster. And although I left New Hampshire with a strange affection for the man as a man, I still tremble at the prospect of President Nixon." And that was another one of the things he managed to sneak into Paget magazine.
That Paget piece was kind of a foreshadowing of his coverage 3 or 4 years hence, when he got the assignment from Rolling Stone to cover the campaign. How did Jan Wenner, the founder of Rolling Stone, come to assign this loose cannon to such a momentous story?
Jan Wenner didn't really want to do politics in Rolling Stone. He wanted to stay away from it. But after Hunter had published Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in Rolling Stone in the fall of 1971, he basically said to Hunter, "Well, what do you want to do?" And Hunter was under the thumb of this long-standing contract to write this book called The Death of the American Dream, which, you know, sounds awfully ponderous. And he couldn't figure out how to get a handle on this. And so he thought, well, maybe the American dream is trapped inside this monster called politics. And so he asked Wenner if he could cover that campaign. And at that point, you know, Wenner would have said, go cover a cockfighting match or something. He was so enamored of Hunter. So he gave him kind of carte blanche, knowing he might be a little, oh, shall we say, unreliable. So he signed another reporter to go with him, another Rolling Stone reporter, basically to serve as Hunter's babysitter, to make sure that, you know, he woke up on time, he got on the campaign bus on time, and that he filed his stories on time.
Now, the babysitter was a guy named Timothy Krause, who, as a result of babysitting Hunter Thompson, was one of the boys on the bus and would write a book called The Boys on the Bus about the experience of covering the campaign. As a boy on the bus himself, Thompson both appalled and inspired the rest of the press corps, essentially by writing all the things that they were thinking but never would have thought to put in print.
In the early days of the campaign, all the other reporters on the bus, they'd be ready to leave the campaign site in the morning to go to the candidate's first speech of the day or whatever, and they're waiting, you know, why the hell aren't we leaving? We're behind schedule. Why aren't we leaving? And then on the bus would come this thug in a bucket hat, you know, with a cigarette holder, carrying a six-pack of ale, noisily grumbling his way down the aisle and bumping people. And this thing around his neck, his press pass, it said Rolling Stone, but the magazine wasn't that well known, and so they figured, hey, some kind of rock and roll star. A couple of weeks into the campaign, Hunter's articles began appearing in Rolling Stone, and suddenly they put two and two together, and they see that this thug that they despise so much in the back of the bus is the guy that's writing all this great prose. And so they really began to buddy up to him, but, you know, Hunter held a grudge. And so he gave Timothy Krause the assignment, and I think the germ of the book that became a classic, The Boys in the Bus. He said, Tim, watch those swine day and night. Every time they have their hand up their ass, every time they f*** someone who isn't their wife, write it down. We'll lay it on them in October. It was a brilliant idea to just turn around and instead of watching the candidate, watch the press, watch the candidate.
Now, he was over the top. Mm-hmm. He was a character in his own writing. He was quintessentially unobjective. He was all of the things that traditional journalists weren't supposed to be. And he even just made stuff up.
One of the people I interviewed for my book was Frank Mankiewicz, who was running the McGovern campaign, and he said that Hunter's book was the least factual but most accurate account of that campaign. You know, who was behind the curtain? Who was manipulating? Who were the people within the campaign that actually were writing the speeches and shaping the policy? Hunter Thompson came along, and that was the subject of his stories.
Can you give me a passage from Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail that you think is Hunter S. Thompson in his purest form?
There's this beautiful passage that I love. This may be the year when we finally come face to face with ourselves. Finally, just lay back and say it, that we are really just a nation of 220 million used car salesmen, with all the money we need to buy guns and no qualms about killing anybody else in the world who tries to make us uncomfortable. The tragedy of all this is that George McGovern, for all of his imprecise talk about new politics and honesty in government, is really one of the few men who've run for president of the United States in this century who really understands what a fantastic monument to all the best instincts of the human race this country might have been if only we could have kept it out of the hands of greedy little hustlers like Richard Nixon. And I really believe that Nixon was his muse. And then when Nixon died, Hunter wrote one of his masterpieces, his obituary of Richard Nixon, called simply, He Was a Crook.
Could you read from that obituary? Because the affection that you mentioned earlier in the football interview seemed to have run its course.
Hunter was in New Orleans when he learned of Nixon's death, and he was with the historians Stephen Ambrose and Douglas Brinkley, and also with Ed Bradley of CBS News. And so they went out to honor Nixon by getting drunk in the French Quarter. And every bar they went into, Hunter would stick his head in and said, Nixon's dead. Does anyone want acid? And at the same time, he realized that this was a real challenge for him because he knew that he would have to write about it. He would have to put Nixon to rest. He also knew that one of the most hideous things ever written by one human being about another human being was H.L. Mencken's obituary for William Jennings Bryan when he died in 1925, right after the monkey trial. So he said to Douglas Brinkley that night over drinks, I have to out Mencken Mencken. And I think he did. If the right people had been in charge of Nixon's funeral, his casket would have been launched into one of those open sewage canals that empty into the ocean just south of Los Angeles. He has poisoned our water forever. Nixon will be remembered as a classic case of a smart man shitting in his own nest. But he also shit in our nests. And that was the crime that history will burn on his memory like a brand, by disgracing and degrading the presidency of the United States, by fleeing the White House like a diseased cur. Richard Nixon broke the heart of the American dream.
Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
William McKean is chair of the journalism department at the University of Florida. He is the author of Outlaw Journalist, The Life and Times of Hunter S. Thompson.
Richard Nixon stands to me for everything that I would not want to have happen to myself or be around. He stands for everything that I not only have contempt for, but dislike and think should be stomped out.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh and John Delore. We also had help from Michael Bernstein. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the School of Visual Arts, hosting an information session for their new program, Master of Fine Arts in Social Documentary Film, on November 8th at the New York campus. More at mfasocdoc.sva.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.